I would like to introduce our three distinguished speakers this afternoon, whom we're very, very happy to have with us. And what I propose to do is that I will introduce each one of them, then each separately will have their paper for about 20 minutes or so, then I will introduce the second one, and so on. I won't take questions after each speaker's presentation, but if you could treasure your questions, I'm hoping that we will have time for them at the end. Well, if I could first turn to Professor Lalaji Bowne. She studied history at Oxford and then went to Africa, where she taught at a really wide range of universities in Ghana, Uganda, Zambia, and three different universities in Nigeria. She became a Commonwealth visiting professor in the University of Edinburgh as long ago as 1974. And in 1975, she was given an honorary doctorate at the Open University for her services to the education of the underprivileged. She was the first woman to achieve the award of a William Pearson Tolley Prize from Syracuse University in the States. In 1981, she returned to Britain to a professorship in the Department of Adult and Continuing Education, from which so many of the organizers and speakers have come at this to this conference today. In 2002, having been professor for many years, this university, Glasgow, gave her an honorary D.Litt, Doctor of Letters. She's been important, I think, for commending governments which the West has not usually commended very much or even recognized for their educational achievements. Cuba, for example, Tanzania under Nyerere, Bangladesh. And she's linked this up to their preparedness to place core centrally allocated public funding into this. In recent years, she's been well known, as many of you will realize, for her championing of women's rights to education, pointing out inconvenient facts like, she has also published numerous books, amongst them Education in the Commonwealth, The First 40 Years, Maintaining Universal Primary Education, Lessons from the from Commonwealth Africa, Women's Literacy for Development, African Adult Education, and the one I think which has a really lovely title, A Rusty Person is Worse Than a Rusty Iron, Adult Education. So I'd like to ask Lalaji whether she'll come and speak to us or sit there and speak to us.
Well, with such friends, who needs enemies? I wrote three or four lines in your document thinking that was sufficient, but I'm very touched. Thank you, Bridget. You see, I've made a summary, but I want to relate it to what's happened today. And before I get on to that, I want to start with a cautionary tale. All these governments got together for education for all and the Millennium Development Goals. And our government, the Westminster government, I think we can be quite proud of, that they committed through DFID £1 billion, which was to be used for the promotion of education and literacy between now and 2015. Now we have a government that is deciding whether to honor those commitments entered into and to do away with the ones which they think will cause the least outcry if they do away with them. That's their criterion. If it's something that they think there will be a huge outcry, like the Gurkhas, they'll stick to it. If it's something like education and literacy, they don't think there'll be a huge public outcry, so they're likely to ditch it. And I think that's a very important lesson for us to think of. I was shocked when I saw that this document was leaked. It was the briefing for the Secretary of State, and it showed least likely to cause a public outcry, and it included education and literacy. And I think in a way we can see this, because if we ask ourselves, how many radio programs, how many newspaper supplements, how many newspaper articles there were this week about International Literacy Day in this country? Any? None. And so I think we're sitting here fired up, and I'm not trying to be depressing, but I'm just trying to fire us up more, because we mustn't stick in our own little cocoon. We have to get out there among other people and try and get them to understand what this is about. Otherwise, all our efforts, whether in Scotland, whether in the UK, whether in the wider world, are going to be dissipated, and we're going to be disillusioned and frustrated. I wouldn't want that to happen, and I don't think it will, because I think all of us here are more determined than that. But I think we have to notice these inconvenient factors, as Bridget said. Otherwise, we may be too complacent. So I wanted to start with that. Now then, my jumping off point is to do with the international commitments and percepts. Old as I am, I remember I was alive and kicking, quite kicking, when the United Nations Charter was signed in San Francisco. Through the years, I've witnessed all the different international documents about education and about literacy. And we have all our governments have at one time or another signed up to the idea that there should be a public obligation to literacy skills, and starting with the idea that literacy is a human right, a human right. And for many, the facilitation of literacy has involved other concepts like human development, social justice, empowerment, and transformation. I'm going to say something about empowerment again in a minute. I think I better say a word about transformation, because ultimately that's our goal. But again, I think we have to underline, transformation is not like in the pantomime, that the curtain goes up and everybody is suddenly in their spangled tights. Transformation in societies or communities, whether communities in a geographical area or communities of interest across areas in this global world, these things will take time, and we have to have patience and a long view and not imagine it's going to happen tomorrow. And don't get disconcerted. And I'm old enough, I think I can say this, Bounds homely sayings, that you know, you can live a long life and you can still not see everything happen that you hoped would happen. But the point is that transformation is an ideal which we work towards. But I think that empirical observation and research does give us some justification for associating literacy with all these things, with social justice, and I want to come back to that, with development and so on, whether in this country or in the wider world. And one of the declarations which was made by the international community, which I rather like because I think it is realistic but also inspiring, is something called the Declaration of Persepolis. And in 1975, the nations of the world came together to make a declaration about literacy. Adama knows this very well, all these, very familiar. And in a way, it was a pity we lost the Shah, because he was rich enough to give us a huge amount of money for literacy work. So, however, there we are. But I'm afraid Mr. Ahmadinejad is not helping us in the same way. But the serious point is, this is what they said, and I think, and I put it in my summary, so it's there for you. Literacy, like education in general, is not the driving force of historical change. It is not the only means of liberation, but it is an essential instrument for all social change. And I think we have to accept, and we all believe this, I think that's why we're in this game, that some variety of literacy is an essential component of any strategy for change and development, whether it's in Scotland or whether it's in Tanzania, or whether it's in Peru, or wherever it happens to be. And I think we can accept that there is a liberating capacity in literacy. And again, we see this from empirical observation and research. And while we have different arguments about the meaning of the word empowerment, to me, I just want to give two brief illustrations, one empirical and one research-based. One is a story which I used last year in my international literacy lecture when I was in Uganda and I came to a place where there were some widows who'd braved bandit country to come to their class. There was no chairs because nobody had money for chairs, so they were all sitting on the ground or on logs. And there was no money for pens or pencils or anything like that. So they were just writing with sticks in the mud. It was wet. And I thought to myself, foolishly, I should by that time have learnt better, what a pointless exercise. Then I went and I was looking over the shoulder of one of these women and she wrote her name and I looked at it and I said, oh, Lucy. The expression on that woman's face that I had given her an identity from something she had written was something so transformative for her that it really made me understand how important it is, even if it's a stick in the mud, that it can be a hugely important personal effect. And whereas empowerment is not the same as emancipation, empowerment does mean people get a new kind of confidence that they never had before. And to refer to research, some of you will know the work of Nellie Stromquist in Latin America, and she has done systematic research with women's groups in Latin America and again has seen how these women, how their whole outlook has changed by the fact that they've had access to some form of literacy, that they're able to report. We now feel ready to take part in public functions. Before we just used to, when the men said to us, go and look after your pots and pans, we went to look after our pots and pans. But we now know that we have the right to leave our pots and pans and join with the men in some of the things they're doing as well. So that is the Declaration of Persepolis reminding us that literacy is an important component for social change, and part of social change includes these elements, like empowerment in the most basic sense of enabling people to have a self-confidence that they didn't have before. And I don't know why it is, but just the fact of being able to identify something in writing, which is not just between you talking to your neighbor, just does seem to have a really amazing impact. Now that leads me on to my first, I want to make three main points, and having started from Persepolis. And my first main point is something that some of us were in discussion groups talking about this morning, and that's the relationships of literacies within education. And I do want to underline this. It may seem boring and trite and a truism, but we have constantly to try and remind others, even if we know it well ourselves, that literacies sit within the framework, as Adama reminded us, of lifelong education. Literacies are a continuum themselves, but they're within the larger continuum. And we have to keep saying this, and I think we have to keep emphasizing that. And by the way, Bridget just said that last year I led a team on a book about universal primary education. And many countries in Africa got very close to universal primary education in the time of President Nyerere and Nkrumah and co. And then it all backslid. Now, there were various reasons. One of the reasons was because there wasn't what we call a literate environment. People who have been to a literacy class themselves and have understood literacy and value literacy, they then value school education and see the importance of sending their children to school and not just thinking it's a waste of time. And I've seen that in many environments in this country as well as elsewhere. It's particularly important, I think, in the case of women, that when women understand what literacy means, then they have an enthusiasm to send their daughters to school. That means their daughters will maybe be not exposed to her, and the women understand this once they've got the beginnings of literacy. Their daughters are not going to be exposed to harmful practices like female genital mutilation. And it is very interesting how FGM is now beginning to be swept away by some of these women who've gotten education and understand it. If girls go to school and the women understand this, it means they won't be married at 14 because they'll continue with their schooling until later time. So there are reasons, very dramatic reasons that I've cited, but also less dramatic ones, whereby literacy for the adults feeds back to the school. And then secondly, and it's obvious to all of us, And we know this, and this goes back, I think, to Ralph Sinclair's report, that, you know, we associate poor schooling with deprivation and so on, and it's partly because deprivation includes an environment with no books or no computers or no mobile phone or whatever. And the children of people who are in those environments do not have the chance to make the best use of the education. However able they are, they don't have the chance. So, and we have to keep underlining this because so many of our pastors and masters think it's an either-or. Okay, we've got this budget, and all of you who work in local authorities are going to face this. They're going to say, well, we've got to keep the schools going. We're going to give up on the adult literacy side. And we have to try and make them understand that if they abandon the adult literacy, they're going to flaw and vitiate the schooling, and the things have to go together. And I think we also have to make them understand that it is a continuum. I always find it amazing that you see something like the American Army. All their officers spend something like 20% of their working life in continuing education. And yet people grudge some poor soul having 10 weeks to learn how to read or whatever. Well, people who already are privileged, they know the value of continuing education. And we have to make them see that it's equally important for people who are less privileged than themselves. We all do have to learn more things through life, and you can see at my age, and I can't resist telling you this, I had, of course, to face the idea of computers at rather later than many of my younger colleagues, and I was quite pleased with myself. I had a young man to try and show me the basics, and we started out very well, as I thought, and as he left, he stood by the door, and he said, you know, for an old person, you're quite intelligent. Well, as if that wasn't enough of a put-down, he then said, maybe it's because you're a professor. Well, I was lucky. I could afford to pay to go through the continuum. Others can't. So the point I'm making is we have to continue to keep hammering this thing that there is a trade-off between out-of-school literacy and in-school performance and achievement. The second main point I want to make moves on from this. That, you see, is about policy. This is now coming to be about social justice. And I think it is true to say that in the 21st century, people without appropriate literacy skills are always going to be at a social disadvantage. Needn't be so in the past. You know, if you go back to the days of Robert the Bruce and co, it was land and sword play which got you power. But in the 21st century, you can't get any access to any form of power without literacy. And I think this is something to bear in mind. You have to come to grips with people who govern you, and all the people who govern us are literate, and they want us to do literate things, like as Mr. Mann was saying this morning, Mr. Cross was saying this morning, that we have to fill in the census forms. We also have to fill in birth certificates. Horrible stories. Oh, I've got to wind up. I must move on. Let me just quickly say then about social imbalance, that social imbalance is unhealthy for society. And I want to, I'm sorry because I haven't got on to my core. You see, here we are, but Isa's quite right. Let me just say that any of you who haven't read Wilkinson and Pickett, the spirit level, which actually says, and it's true, that societies which are less equal do worse than societies which are more equal. So I think there's a social justice argument for literacy work. I wanted to say something more about women and literacies. Maybe it'll come out in discussion. Just to wind up, I've talked about literacy and culture. And this is something that somebody said at the back about the Scots language, that if people are exposed to literacy which relates to their own cultural background, they're more likely to make better use of it to become more creative in general than if they're just expected to have some kind of one-size-fits-all conversation. And I think that's all I have to say. I just want to go back to Persepolis and say, let us never forget that although literacy, we mustn't overclaim for it, it can't do everything, but without literacy, there will not be social justice, there will not be a change in the unbalance of society, and women especially will continue to be disadvantaged.
Thank you very much indeed, Lala G. As usual, very pithy and illuminating set of comments. I would like to introduce now Michael Omaluwa, and I apologize. How should I pronounce your name? Is that all right? Omaluwa. Dr. Omaluwa was educated at the University of Ibadan in Nigeria, where he got his first degree and then his PhD also in history. He was then at the University of London in the Institute of Historical Research for many years. He's been a professor of history, of history of adult education, and also head of that department of adult education in the same university, University of Ibadan in Nigeria, for a considerable period from 1982 to 2006. But alongside this went an increasing involvement with UNESCO. He was Nigeria's ambassador and permanent delegate to UNESCO in Paris from 2000 to 2009, and president of the 32nd session of the General Conference of UNESCO for over 2 years. Since then, he's moved more from practical and political experience into research. He's deputy chair of the governing board at the Commonwealth of Learning in Vancouver, in Canada, and a member of the Commonwealth Advisory Council on Teacher Mobility, Recruitment, and Migrations. To move from Dean of the Faculty of Education to UNESCO prominence, and then to much-needed research on teacher mobility, I think shows considerable adaptability and a capacity to keep hold of what's important in terms of understanding the dynamics of education and of educators. So I want to encourage you to look at his publications if you haven't already done so. He's written on adult education practice in Nigeria, literacy programs, development and evaluation process in Africa, the adult literacy census in Nigeria, and he's had essays published in his honor, Widening Access to Education, Social Justice, again taking up the theme of social justice. So we are very honored indeed, to repeat the word, to have Michael Omaluwa with us, and I'd like to invite him to speak now.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Bridget. Like Lala J, you have done much more than I sent in. And it shows the quality of mind of our chair, for whom I have the most profound respect. Thank you very much indeed, and God bless you. My time is 20 minutes. And so what I intend to do is to spend about 10 seconds congratulating the Scotland Committee of the UK National Commission. I hope at an appropriate time I'll be able to show my appreciation, because I've got excellent reports of the quality of work that this Scotland Committee has been doing, and I'm very proud to be associated with this outstanding work of this Scotland Committee of the UK National Commission. I then wanted to show that my idea is to look at interpreting the world through the written word. I hope I will then try and focus on the specific area of health at some stage. But that's what I will be doing for the rest of the rest of the time. But like Bridget said, I currently live and work in London, and associated with the Commonwealth Advisory Council on Teacher Mobility, Recruitment and Migration. I'm sure that that's a topic that will always be very pertinent to literacy. Basically then, I like to suggest that because of the nature of literacy, there has been a lot of effort to try and define what literacy is. And when you have access to my text, you will then find how I try to show that UNESCO itself, being at the vanguard from 1949 in Elsinore, and then moving on in 1960 with the excellent work of Ruby Kidd of Canada, you know, to try at the meeting in 1960 to try and take up the challenges of adult education. And that, of course, gave birth to the work of people like Bud Hall, and you know, those very dedicated people that really assisted us during those years. And then on, as we know, to 1972 in Tokyo, and then 1985 now with Margaret Geifer, again Bud Hall, you know, coming in 1985 in Paris to try and look at what the right to learning is, and that you cannot have the right to learning without really looking at literacy as well. And then from there we get, of course, to 1997 in Hamburg, and the story moves on. Then I tried in my paper to try and identify some of those key elements, the works of John Oxenham when he was at the World Bank, trying to defend literacy, since the bank wanted a concrete evidence, you know, that, you know, of the use of literacy. And then, of course, the series of Habans Bola and Paul Fordham and Alan Rogers, you know, of Kaita, Dan Wagner, of course, you know, I made mention of Lalaji. I did not know that she would actually be at this meeting, because on Tuesday, on the 16th of October, 1971, she sat at an interview panel in which she recommended that I be appointed as an assistant lecturer in adult education. And of course, I've continued to read her work since then. Talk about Sunday Hezekiah Oluwaruwo Tomori, Edwin Tansen Coase of Botswana, Conrad Brown and G.F. Adeyajayi. We have series of them, Roland Oliver and all, you know, the whole lot. But then I'm trying to say that the work has moved on, you know, since then, and that therefore I will not spend time on this. I'm sure you all know, you know, this background literature. But I wanted to give an idea to suggest that the spoken word is also impressive and very important, and that this was the beauty in the pre-literate African society, where we could not write, but where we had the inculcation of values of integrity, honesty, loyalty, fear of God, and that treachery and betrayers were severely punished, you know, in the system without literacy at the time, and that the women who were illiterate, they were better traders with their encyclopedic knowledge. But that the problem is that the literacy itself, that the word without the written word would not be, you know, complete. And I try to identify, you know, the potentials of writing for development. And you can see with all you've been hearing since morning, you know that will not be relevant for me to take on at the moment. But I just noted that even Jesus Christ himself, you know, was writing on the ground. You remember when the woman was caught in adultery, was brought to his attention, he started writing. What he was writing and all that, we don't know. But the very fact that it was reported that the Son of God was doing the writing, that I thought was very significant. The reading of the word, I said, you know, if you don't read and you don't write, then you cannot continue to influence the future. And I try to show from the story of the eunuch of Ethiopia who was reading, you know, remember from his travel he was reading. And of course the film Educating Rita, you remember, I'm sure many of you remember what Educating Rita was trying to teach, you know, in terms of, you know, reading to be able to, you know, to discover yourself. And therefore I then concluded with the comment by Orson that speech makes us human and literacy makes us civilized. So we can be human without being civilized. But if we are literate, you can both be human as well as civilized. And then try to give some of the reasons for all that, but you know, I will not have time to develop all that. I hope that you will see that from my writing. Now, I decided to give some examples from Africa, and I tried to quote Brian in my paper. You know, and you know, he said that for the Africa, maybe I should just say it. This Simon Barnes, he's a writer for The Times, and he wrote in his contribution. He says, Africa is great. Africa is full of great people doing great things. Africa is a place of joy, of inspiration, and of hope. To spend time in Africa is to change your understanding of the world, and to do so for the better. Every visitor to Africa, no matter how generous, gains more from Africa than he is capable of giving. Africa is not a basket case. Africa is not a place without hope, without ambition, without plan. Africa is not remarkable only for its wounds, whether self-inflicted or inflicted from outside. Africa remains Africa. It is greater than we can understand and infinitely richer. And, you know, I then decided to give some of my examples from Africa. The example, what one of them said, you know, that I open my heart in the letters and I write what nobody would know except my friends. When I receive confidential letters, nobody knows my secret except the persons in whom I confide. And this witness was trying to compare the situation before literacy and now, you know, that she became literate. Because in the past, she would then dictate what she wanted and somebody else would write. And that was like giving herself up. And that's the type of things that there's no money that can buy. I also gave the example of the one saying that I can now sign my check. In my checkbook, so that at least nobody even knows the balance, you know, of your checkbook. Once you can sign and read, you know, have your account yourself. I then will now be leading on now to say I can vote, and that's very, very important. And then I try to say that that's okay for literacy. But I think Lalaji and all the others today have been emphasizing this important point about the future of literacy. What will you do without being able to read? I mean to use to send a text message or to receive a text message, and then I then try to focus attention on some of those marginalized. I think it's one in 28, the one that Ralph was talking on earlier today. I was talking of the refugees. I was talking of the immigrant population. I was talking of the underprivileged, the voiceless, those people that we must actually focus attention on, so that when they are trying to get on in this difficult, complex society, you know, and trying to study the society, you know, the asylum seekers, the poor and the disadvantaged, then we then discover that it is mandatory, it is part of social justice that we should be able to focus on them. And then I said that related to literacy, related to health, that literacy can be applied, you know, for the health issue, that you can begin now to look at the classes, you know, you organize literacy classes, you know, to as bedrock for social activities, because the isolated people we find out have been told, you know, we've been told that the cause of depression is really not relating to other people, and that literacy classes can actually be a form of solution to that problem of depression, loneliness, and isolation. And that I try to give the example of that university that says that the social isolation can be equivalent to smoking 15 cigarettes a day, and that therefore, even for health itself, fighting obesity and all that, that literacy, you know, activity, it, you know, it can be a prescription. But that we can even go beyond that and begin to see the example of the awareness of issues like drinking safe water and sanitation and hygiene. And we also have the example I try to give the example from our own health project at home, that everybody believes now that if you attend literacy, then even for your own health, you have the hope, you have the encouragement, you can also pursue a healthy life, and then you share the experiences of others, and then you can also read, you know, you can read the prescription, and then you can also find out some of the problems that are causing the ailments. You can even Google, you know, you can have, and then you find that you are happy, you keep on living a happy life. And with now that I have just 3 more minutes, I then said that I will spend that 3 minutes by saying that I hope you all have access to my paper, and I then wanted to say Africa has always had very, very close relationship with Scotland, and that two of the major outposts for the training of the earliest Nigerian educated elite were King's College London and the Universities of Scotland, and that the first set of Nigerian medical students, William Broughton Davies and James Africanus Bill Houghton, were trained in Scotland, and they became the first medically qualified Africans in 1858 and 1859. And that therefore it should be it is important for Africans to be able to appreciate the investment in the education of Africa when it was getting to its feet. But I then said that it is that my enthusiasm to accept the invitation to share my thoughts today was also informed by the noble role that Scotland had historically played in the development of Africa, and that indeed the history of Africa cannot be complete without mention the role that the people of Scotland played in assisting the region. And I tried to bring in the work of David Livingstone. And I said this David Livingstone came to Africa, especially South Africa, Botswana, Zambia, Zimbabwe, and Malawi. And he brought the message about Jesus Christ, and he introduced reading, focusing attention at that time on the Bible. And of course, the people looked at his name, which they called Livingstone, which, you know, by the way, is the stone that lives. And that since the stone lives forever, and that is symbolic of Jesus Christ, whom he tried to introduce to that part of Southern Africa, that Jesus Christ, even though he's dead, he's alive again and is living forever. He is the living stone. And then from there, I tried to introduce Mungo Park, you know, the Mungo Park, the Scottish explorer who led the historic expedition to the coast of River Niger, and therefore was able to bring development across that River Niger, after which Nigeria actually took its name in 1897. And that after Mungo Park, we also had the work of the Presbyterian Mission that established the activities, especially in eastern Nigeria, and brought industrial education through the Hope Waddell Institute, and that many of the products of that Hope Waddell Institute contributed to the independence movement of Nigeria. I cited the work of Mary Slessor, the young lady who was helpful in ensuring that twins were no longer killed. Those are the ones that I've said. I have just 1 more minute, and I said, young and old, male and female, they came to Africa, they lived and served there, and they died there, leaving the legacy of the written word. And that this UK, this 2010 Glasgow lecture is for me a completion of my work, starting with the University of London, where I was a Commonwealth Fellow about 35 years ago, and from University of London, coming to the University of Glasgow, and therefore concluding, you know, that pilgrimage that was done by my ancestors, and for which I therefore thank you, and God bless you.
told us that, Africa was once more prosperous than Europe itself. So in the 17th century. So maybe it can regain that prosperity. I'd like to introduce for our third speaker, César Guadalupe, who is like me, a sociologist with degrees. Later, he became a lecturer in the same Catholic University of Peru and head of the Peruvian Research into Political Administration, head of the Analysis Unit at the Planning Division of the Peruvian Education Ministry as well. He became a consultant on education statistics at UNESCO, and particularly as a regional advisor. He has since become the senior program specialist at UNESCO since May 2007. His main concern, his major area of concern, is the linkage between social development, quality development, all areas which we've been touching on throughout today's conference. His specialist areas particularly are revolving around political sociology, political philosophy, social theory, and education. His publication has been measuring universal primary Latin America, quality education for all, a human rights issue, again looking particularly at the regional educational project in Latin America, and assessing the goal of universal primary education. So he's particularly an authority on an area, Latin America, which I myself very much I'm keen to learn more about. It's particularly complex, obviously, because of very early colonization and the great threat this imposed to indigenous languages. The development of linguistic literacy skills then occurs within the context of linguistic hegemony and, indeed, the resulting linguistic hybridity. So I'm very interested to hear what he will say about this and other subjects. Thank you.
Thank you so much for the introduction. I have to share the same feelings that the previous speaker said about getting more information than the thing we send. Okay, let me try. Before going straight to the personal appreciation for having the opportunity to be first here in Scotland, and second with all of you here sharing some basic, the opportunity to share with you some ideas or some of the things that we have learned over the past few years trying to measure literacy skills across different countries of the world, and also personally for having the opportunity to share this panel and this day with these amazing colleagues here. It's an honor for me to be part of this today. Before I start with I need to say something else. I work for the Institute for Statistics, but the good thing is that you already know that I'm not a statistician. And I need to say that for one reason, because working on education, I'm used to see a sort of schizophrenic relationship with the statistics. On one side, we hate that thing. We usually take that thing at its face value. The numbers are there, and then there's some kind of mysterious thing. So if someone comes and say X 0.5% of something happens, it should be X 0.5%. Nobody criticizes it. And we should. But the tricky thing is that in order to criticize the things, we have to understand it. And that's a tricky part. So let me start with something that we just released. I mean, we in the Institute for Statistics released last week. I mean, it's in relation to the literacy rates and the numbers that were mentioned in the morning. I mean, we talk about 796 million people being reporting not being able to read and write. And sometimes we find about 796 or 94. So, but I'm going to do something that is not usual with this. These are the literacy rates we have today in the world. But I would like you to pay attention to something that we usually don't do, to pay attention not to the figures, but the parts of the world where we don't have figures, which are this. Usually it's the other way around, yeah? But not for literacy rates. Why not? Because these countries don't produce literacy rates. Because if you produce literacy rates that are, let's say, 97%, 98%, 99%, you don't get much information out of that. Adama said in the morning, if you go to a country like those in red there, meaning less than 50%, you already have something. Something that is actionable. Something that works. It's good enough to say, oh, we have an issue here. We have a real problem here. We might not know some other things about it. But at least we have a big alert. And that's good enough for policy, for at least to start doing something. But in these other countries, I mean, there is a risk. There is no issue about it. Just in this country. And that's the problem with the discourse about the eradication of illiteracy. Once we eradicate illiteracy, the literacy issue disappears. And that's a risk. That's a major risk. So the problem with this distribution of the no data is that these countries discover that literacy is not about literate and illiterate, but it's about this continuum of skills and finding out how these skills are actually distributed in society, and finding out that there are some groups of populations where literacy skills exist but might be weak and need to be improved, and actually need to be improved for everybody. Because it's a matter of how these literacy skills link to this idea of lifelong learning. So the question is, if these countries, actually the US started doing this in the early 80s, and then we have some international studies in the 90s, I mean, Ralph in the morning mentioned the International Adult Literacy Survey conducted between 93 and 98 in total, I mean, it was a long period. And another sequel of that study was the Adult Literacy and Life Skills Survey conducted between 2003 and 2005. Those were the most important international experiences. But we don't have a measure of skills in any other part of the world. So one of the things, and Adama mentioned that we started this program that I am responsible for in 2003, it was how can we measure literacy and numeracy skills around the world, in those places where they don't have these measures. Why this is important? Because something that I think was embedded in your observation in the morning, Kathy, because is we need to know. I mean, you are all educators probably here, and you know that one of the risks is that if I put a label, illiterate, that is equal for everybody, I mean, my educational program might not work, because one size fits all kind of solution might not be the good solution. That is embedded in this discussion about the war of the methods that Adama mentioned in the morning. This method is better, this method is better, this method is better than the others. The problem is the context. The problem is the populations are different. Those that are labeled as illiterate are not equal, are not homogeneous. So we need to get something about what they are able to do today. Actually, they can do some for staff. They might not be able to do some other things. But that's a good point. To start with an educational experience. If we know the previous knowledge of the learner, we have a basic element to design a learning experience. So that's the reason why that's one of the good reasons why measuring skills is important. And we need to think, as UNESCO, we need to think about that, and we need to find ways to do this across the world. So actually what we decided in 2003 was to start by learning from the OECD experience, which are these two studies that were conducted. Some of our colleagues, in a very naive way, basically thought about replicating the thing. I mean, you mentioned someone earlier that I'm not going to quote because this is going to be recorded, but you mentioned someone who said, okay, we already have the methods, let's apply this everywhere. It's going to work. It didn't. It couldn't. There's no way these good things can work everywhere, and I'm going to explain. I mean, most of the reflections that I'm going to share with you are exactly related to that. The good thing about that is that when we tried that and that thing didn't work, that created a huge mess. And I've been responsible for cleaning up the mess, meaning that I have learned a lot. That's a good thing about that story. In any case, replicating or not replicating whatever was done in the OECD countries require validating the approach, validating the tools before launching a program on a more global scale. I mean, that's a basic thing you have to do in research. You have to validate what you have. So we have been working with some countries, and so far, I mean, Rath's presentation from the morning saved me from explaining what we have done because it's quite similar. This idea of measuring basically reading skills in prose and document, in these two scales, prose and document, which is continuous and non-continuous text. And in addition to that, measuring some quantitative or numeracy skills, basically numeracy skills as mediated by written materials is what we are doing. In addition to that, the main difference between what we have been doing and what the survey that you conducted here in Scotland last year is that we added something else to that approach. We added a specific module, what is called reading components, which are the very, very basic skills or competencies that you have to have in order to be able to read. Being able to recognize letters, numbers, being able to decode words, being able to read fluently a passage and a paragraph. Those things become automatic processes in competent readers, but that's what you need to master first in order to, let's say, complete the process of learning to read and being able to read for another purpose. So we added a module on that actually because we want to look at the lower end of the distribution because we're expecting that the lower end of the distribution in many countries of the world will not be 1 in 28 people. Will be something different from that. And we need more detailed information in that lower end to have a body of evidence that is enough for policy, for designing policy and program interventions. So that's the major difference, but the rest is basically the same thing. We have worked with these countries so far, which are 8 countries in different parts of the world, El Salvador, Jordan, Mongolia, Morocco, Niger, the occupied Palestinian territories, Paraguay, and Vietnam. Quite a diverse world. Let me compare that thing with the OECD experience just for a second to illustrate one of the key issues here. We have only 8 countries. They did this in 22. Okay, that's okay. They work in 15 languages. We work in 10 languages. A little bit. But the main difference is this, is that these 15 languages are all European languages. And we have worked with languages belonging to 6 different linguistic families that are completely different. I mean, it's not the same to learn to read in a language like Vietnamese, which is basically syllabic, than doing this in a European language. And even for European languages, learning to read in English is not the same as learning to read in Spanish. I mean, there is something that is called orthographic transparency or orthographic depth. It's different in these languages. If you know the basic rules of decoding in Spanish, actually you can read this text that is in Spanish here. You might not be able to understand it, but you might be able to decode it properly. You cannot do that in English, and that's the reason why you have in the schools a lot of things about the spelling. Because double O doesn't sound the same way all the time. Flot is not the same as loo. I mean, and you know that thing. I mean, that's related to orthographic transparency. And you need to learn these things in a different way. And I'm just talking about alphabetic languages. I'm not talking about logographic languages, which is a completely different thing. I mean, ask a Chinese about the importance of the number of strokes when they write. or ask a Japanese about the three scripts that they use, actually four when they romanize their own language. Okay, so that created some problems for us, especially if we also relate the fact that it's not about the number of languages and the number of families, it's also the number of scripts and the number of numeral systems. So we have been working with this diversity. That is not all the diversity that there is in the world, but it's good enough as a starting point. And we have learned a few things, and that's what we want to say. One of the things that we have in our current definitions of literacy, whatever the definitions are, might be different, is that they talk about reading, writing, using numbers in real life, basically. What is a real life situation when you try to develop a test? In a test, what is real life? Who's real life to begin with? One thing is the real life of those who develop a test in a hypothetical setting like Princeton, or, I mean, just to mention an hypothetical scenario, than preparing item tests in a different context. I don't know why you're laughing. I mean, is it possible to develop and use cognitive items that are universally valid? Is it possible to find that kind of stuff? Because we want to have comparable information. Literacy is a human concern, a universal concern. We want to have them. Of course, do they exist? I mean, some people say yes. And when they say yes, basically what they are revealing is an amazing degree of ethnocentrism. Whatever we do here, not Princeton today, Ottawa, just to say another place, casual place, I mean, works everywhere in the world because the whole world is the same, and if it's not the same, should be the same. They might not have a shopping mall in Niamey, but just a matter of time. So one of the tricky things is that we should have proper translation, adaptation, and in some case, developmental guidelines, because there are things that have to be created out of scratch, from the scratch, because they don't work exactly the same way. There are things that are language-specific or script-specific that have to be developed, and that's true. Second thing, paper and pencil tests. That's the way we test things in education, yes? What about population with no schooling experience? That are not used to tests to begin with, or where differences between reading and writing might be huge. I mean, we all learn to read and write together at the same time, basically. What about those who never went to school and learned to read in one way and probably never learned to write? If you're going to test, as you did here in your test, and we do at the same time. We test reading skills using paper and pencil tests. You're asking people to write in order to measure reading. Is that immaterial to the results? Sometimes it's not, and that's something that we need to check. What about official, non-official, oral languages? What are we going to do with this? And those things are not innocent things, are related to power structures, are related to distribution of opportunities and fundamental rights. And it's not easy. These issues are not easy to sort out. I mean, I come from a country where we have something like 62 languages. But if you don't learn Spanish, you're dead. So it's not the same. I mean, and of course, people is entitled to learn and study, et cetera, in their own language. Great. But your window of opportunities will be completely different because of the way languages and power are intertwined. I mean, I'm speaking here in English. Sorry, there is a reason for that. And actually, you are speaking in English. And there is a reason for that. Same. No? Globalization is a real process. Yes? Yeah. Globalization is a real process, but it's different from a globalization agenda, is what I said about the shopping mall in Niamey. So it's about quantitative items or numeracy items being basically equivalent to market-related items. Sorry, I mean, there are different things to measure in this. Shouldn't be And of course, there are problems that are related to what we do. I mean, we are not a testing company running a study just because we want to have the data. We have to provide a service over member states. So there are issues about ownership here. If we have a contractor doing the whole staff, who's going to be able to replicate that if the contractor has everything here? You will never know how plausible values are computed. Not even know why plausible values are computed or what the hell plausible values are. I mean, those things are part of this tricky thing because actually testing is a business and we shouldn't be naive about that. And the other thing is, why do we care about literacy skills? And there are different views about this and different views that are behind the decisions that we made in our study design. Is a fundamental human right or is something that has an instrumental or utilitarian value? The answer to that leads, for instance, to what's the target population for my study. Those who are 66 and over, I don't care about them. They are not part of the active population. And actually, education is about rates of return. It's not about fundamental human rights. That's a discussion I have with my wife. Why do you pay several years of overseas student tuition fees in a UK university to get a doctoral degree and your salary hasn't changed at all? Okay, I mean, it's because I believe in this thing about lifelong learning, etc. It's not an investment, it's an expenditure. Right? I mean, everything has to be paid. There is no free lunch. Nobody asks what is the rate of return of having elections. We pay for that thing at the same time. If this were a real right, nobody would be asking about it. I mean, it's important to have to say that there are connections with economic growth and other things. I'm not denying that thing. But the bottom line is, if it's a right, we have to pay for it. That's it. End of the story. Yep. So let me say just two things to complete the thing. First, I mean, I already say that we have these things about, I mean, what literacy includes these are areas of reading, writing, and text-mediated numeracy, not all numeracy skills. I mean, you can be very competent performing some skills like, for instance, sorry, I think I skipped something that I wanted to say. No. I mean, what's the impact of playing darts in a pub on your numeracy skills? And probably you do that orally, and someone else takes the scores in the board. You can do that. That's part of life. But that's not necessarily something written. I mean, we compute things, and I mean, for literacy, we usually include that thing. In our tests, in the tests that you run here, in the tests that we're running, we're not including writing because it's too complex in terms of administering a scoring. And if I do a test and I have to write something, I don't know how someone is going to score that thing because myself, I cannot read what I write after 2 hours. Okay? And of course, there is a discussion about these other literacies, health literacy, computer literacy, information literacy, whatever literacy you want. And there is a connection between these two things. But what I would like to say is that you have to be very clear in terms of what do we mean by literate in this context, or by literacy in this context. We usually mean to be able to cope competently with situations that are related to X. And that is not necessarily text-mediated. Mediated by written materials. And we have to be very careful about that. Yeah, not always requires literacy in the sense of dealing with written materials. You can manage information broadcasted by a radio station without reading and writing. I mean, are oral cultures condemned to be considered competent because of this? Or not. I mean, there are many things that you can do. I mean, the word doesn't end in the written part of it. The written part of it is very important in terms of all the things that enable us to do, but it's not the end of the word. And finally, there is an interaction, and that interaction is related to what is called the literate environment. how we live and what our everyday lives are. And that's also that is related to the way we measure these things. We usually measure the literate environment in relation to home, how many books, how many hours, how many things you do at home or at work. But what we usually overlook is the local community activity. I mean, and that's not accidental. I mean, usually if we have an individualistic approach to this, we overlook that part. And those are decisions that we are embedded in the designs of our studies for different reasons. Okay. So, just to wrap up in 15 seconds. This is difficult, and it's difficult because it combines three different things. Household survey techniques, you have to test people in their houses, and that has a problem. Educational testing techniques, and that has its own word of complexity, but also because of these other things that are behind the design that impact what we're measuring. The kind of political discourses and political interests that are behind this. We need to foster the public interest, and that's the reason why what we're doing is not a study. We're running a study. It's basically an effort to develop a methodology that is going to be available for countries to promote the development of capacity so that the countries can do this by themselves. And therefore, the combination of these two things should lead to a sustainable production of data. Okay. In any case, if you want to read more about this, there's a publication called The Next Generation of Literacy Statistics that is available on our website. If you go to our website, please don't visit the part of this project because it hasn't been updated for quite a long time. We've been very busy with all these problems, so we haven't paid much attention to the website. But it's going to be updated in about 2 months. So, but you can download those documents, which is a description of this. And thank you so much for your attention. Thank you. Bye-bye.